This is HeartWise, offering practical tips and time-proven guidelines to make your life healthier, happier, and more fulfilling. Today you'll learn simple Bible-based principles for building and maintaining optimum mental and physical health, all while deepening your relationship with your Creator. I'm your HeartWise host, Charles Mills. Today we know more about the human brain than ever before. We also know how to manipulate it in ways unimagined 100 years ago. Feeling depressed? Here's a medicine. Experiencing anxiety? Here's another medicine. Dealing with anger or rage? Yeah, we've got a medicine for that too. Which begs the question, why, with all that we know and all that we can prescribe, is medical illness skyrocketing around the world? Our guest today addresses this conundrum in his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, a release The New Scientist describes as enthralling and frighteningly persuasive. It also earned the author a place on the finalist list for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Robert Whitaker, welcome to HeartWise.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, Bob, why on earth did you tackle this particular subject? Give us the backstory.
Well, this actually goes back to a series I did a long time ago in 1998 for the Boston Globe. And at that time, I had a completely conventional understanding of psychiatric drugs and what they did. And my understanding was that the drugs fixed chemical imbalances in the brain, and this represented a great advance in care of the mentally ill, and thus, therefore, we had these very effective treatments for schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, etc. But then when I was doing that series for the Boston Globe in 1998, which actually was just focusing on abuses of psychiatric patients in research settings, I came upon a couple of studies that made me question that truism. And one was by the World Health Organization, which twice found that outcomes for schizophrenia patients were much better in the poor countries of the world, specifically India, Nigeria, and Colombia, than in the U.S. and other rich countries. Once they did that first study, they said, why would this be? And then they looked at medication usage in the poor countries versus the rich countries, and they found that in the poor countries, where people had much better functional outcomes, they weren't maintaining people on antipsychotics long-term, as a matter of course. And this all of a sudden went directly contrary to what I knew to be true, and that led me to start investigating, well, what does the science tell us about the long-term effects of psychiatric medications? First, I focused on antipsychotics in a book called Mad in America. And then after that was published, people kept asking me, well, what about the long-term effects of antidepressants, the long-term effects of benzodiazepines? And in Anatomy of an Epidemic, what I did then is just look at what is research telling us about the long-term effects of these drugs. And when you look at that science, you find time and time again a paradox, which is that drugs that may be effective over the short term appear to be increasing the chronicity of these disorders over the long term. So my point here is, in terms of the background to how I got into this, is I was a completely, you know, working as a journalist, had a completely conventional understanding, which was that psychiatry is making great progress in understanding the biology of disorders, and we now had drugs that fix those biological problems. But then when I dug into the scientific literature, I found a different story there that was, frankly, out of sync with that public story.
What is the scope of this problem? Give us some numbers here to go along with the fact that it's skyrocketing. What are we talking about here?
Well, the first thing is, let's just focus on the United States and look at disability rates. Mm-hmm. So these are a number of people who are being declared eligible for federal payments because they're no longer able to work or function well in society because of a mental illness. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1987, there were about 1.25 million adults disabled by mental illness and receiving either an SSI or SSDI payment due to mental illness. In 2014, and we're at about 5 million adults disabled by mental illness. So that's a fourfold increase. We can also look at what's happening to children now that we're diagnosing so many children and putting them on medications. In 1987, there were 16,200 children receiving a disability payment because of mental illness. Now we're at about 700,000 children receiving such disability payments. Now, disability payments are just a marker for a larger problem. And so if we look at the number of people today said to be having a mental illness, it's around 20-25% of the American population. About 15-20% of kids have been diagnosed with a mental disorder by the time they graduate from high school. Depression is now the second leading cause of disability worldwide. So everywhere you look, whatever data you look at, you see this exploding sense of the burden of mental illness in our society. And it has happened, this exploding burden of mental illness in society, as measured by disability rates, number of people being treated, expenditures on treatments, etc., is happening at the very time that we have embraced widespread usage of psychiatric drugs. So, final thing is, in 1987, we as a society spent about $800 million on psychiatric medications. Now, this is the year that Prozac arrives on the market, and this is when we as a society start using these drugs in great abundance. And now here we are, 25 years later, we're spending more than $40 billion a year on psychiatric medication. That's like a 50-fold increase. And what has happened as this paradigm of care has been embraced? Disability numbers have soared. Problems in our children have soared. So something is going terribly wrong with this paradigm of care.
You have a section in your book called An Episodic Illness Turns Chronic, and you talk a little bit about the way it used to be and the way it is now. 150 years ago, this world was still a chaotic place. There were wars and rumors of wars. There were neighbors that bothered you. There were bosses that got on your cases. What on earth changed in our ability to deal with life in the 1800s, 1900s, compared to the 21st century? What's going on?
Well, that's sort of the big question, of course, because I agree with you. The idea that life is so much tougher today than it was in the mid-1800s, early 1900s, yeah. I think is a rather remarkable statement.
Yes.
But what I did in this book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, to try to understand the effect that drugs have on the long-term course of, say, depression, is look at what did researchers find about the course of depression or even a manic depressive illness, which we know as bipolar today, when they studied people over the long term? And this is even studies of hospitalized patients. And what they found is when people were hospitalized for affective disorders, depression or mania, that episode with great regularity would finally go away on its own. It would abate and people would be discharged from the hospitals. And then if you followed that group of people who had been hospitalized for 5, 10, 15 years, here's the spectrum of outcomes you would see. You'd see about half would never have another episode, at least not serious enough to cause rehospitalization. Mm-hmm. There'd be about another 30% that might have two or three episodes over the course of 15 years. And only about 20% would become chronically depressed or have chronic manic depressive symptoms. So what researchers said, and this is in the pre-drug era, is these are episodic disorders,
right.
And you'll have a period of time that's difficult, but you will recover. Now, what do we say about depressed patients? Well, we say that they have a chronic disorder. How about bipolar? It's chronic. And now when you see the course of modern depression today, in terms of if you look at how often people are depressed once they go on these medications and follow them for 5, 10, 15 years, you actually do see a lot of chronicity today, sort of a lot of persistent, at least low-level depressive symptoms. Same with your bipolar patients. So what you really see when you step back and take this grand view is you see that a disorder that used to be episodic in nature has been transformed into a chronic condition in our modern drug era. And then as you start to say, well, why would that be so? Here's what you find in the literature. Right away, when psychiatrists begin using these drugs, say antidepressants in the 1970s, late 60s, 1970s, they say this. They notice something odd in the clinical course of their patients. Yes, my patients are getting better faster once I give them these drugs, but now it also seems that they're relapsing back into depression more frequently than before. So are these drugs causing a chronification of the disease? So you see that clinical perception. Then next you go through the literature and you see that, yep, people are now relapsing more frequently than before. That's what the studies are showing. Then you look at studies that compare the course of depressed patients who take medication today versus those who do not. And over the long term, you'll see that the unmedicated patients fare better. Better functional outcomes, less likely to be depressed over the long term. So you start to see the pieces of this puzzle being put together. And then finally, as researchers look at this, the very few who dare to do so, they start positing a biological explanation for why these drugs would cause a chronification of the disorder. And what they say is this. You take an antidepressant, it's meant to up serotonergic levels in the brain, right? Mm-hmm. Serotonin being a neurotransmitter. And the way it does that is the drugs block the reuptake of serotonin from these tiny gaps between neurons in the brain. So more serotonin in those gaps. But the brain, being this extraordinarily neuroplastic organ, immediately says, uh-oh, something's happening here. Serotonin is staying too long in this synaptic cleft between neurons. So what does the brain do? The presynaptic neurons start putting out less serotonin than normal, and the receiving neurons for that message actually decrease the density of their receptors for that molecule, serotonin. So the irony is this. You go on the drug, which is supposed to up serotonergic activity, and over the long term, it drives your brain into a serotonergic deficient state. And what researchers have said is, aha, this compensatory mechanism, this adaptation to the drug, may be the reason that these drugs are causing a chronification of the disorder. So if you take all that data, you look at how the course has changed today, you look at how clinicians say, uh-oh, when they first use the drugs, it seems like it's inducing a more chronic course. Then you look at studies that compare medicated versus unmedicated patients today. You see the medicated patients having a more chronic course. And then finally, researchers positing a biological explanation. Boy, those are a lot of pieces of a scientific puzzle being put together and coming to a conclusion that I think is really startling.
We're talking with Robert Whitaker. He is the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, and he has said something in that book, and you just heard him say it here, that may surprise an awful lot of people and make a lot of other people kind of upset at him. And I want to talk to him about that on our return. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more with Robert Whitaker and his book Anatomy of an Epidemic. So stay right where you are.
As a medical professional, I've seen thousands of patients who have needed something more than modern medicine could offer. Over the past 20 years in cardiology, I've discovered another method of treatment. Hi, I'm Dr. James Markham, and I'd like to introduce you to Biblical Prescriptions for Life. This is a Bible-based program designed to help you and your loved ones improve your health one step at a time. This evidence-based information focuses on relationships that empower change. Simple steps based on scriptures are presented which will change your entire chemistry. This program focuses on changing the chemistry of the entire body rather than isolated chemical pathways. The program has the potential to eliminate the need for prescription medications and prevent chronic disease. Visit heartwiseministries.org to discover more about Biblical Prescriptions for Life. That's heartwiseministries.org.
Did you know that last year in the United States, over 4 billion prescriptions were written? Prescription medications seem to be the most popular treatments these days. But what can we do if we want to limit our exposure to prescription medications? At HeartWise, we recognize the importance of nutrition in treating and prevention of disease. Dr. Hippocrates stated, "Let food be thy medicine." Many evidence-based studies support a whole food, plant-based diet. But how is this achieved in the fast-paced world we live in today? We want to encourage those interested in this type of treatment to watch the documentary film Plant Pure Nation and visit the website plantpurenation.com. This is a great first step towards helping yourself move towards better health and helping make the world a better place. Visit plantpurenation.com to start your journey today. That's plantpurenation.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills. Our guest today is Robert Whitaker. He is the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, and he has said something, and he's saying it here on the program, and he has said it in his book, that the solution may be part of the problem when we're dealing with mental illness, and the solution being all the medicines that we're providing. Now, let's back up real quick here and say something. You're not saying for the people who are on medicine right now to stop taking their medicine right now and throw them away.
No, of course not. First of all, I would never give medical advice. I just think this information needs to be out there and the public can discuss it. And anybody making a decision whether or not to go on the medication in the first place you know, will have all this information and can make an informed consent decision.
Right.
But now let's talk about people who are on the medications and maybe aren't doing so well. Well, one of the problems that is quite clear is once your brain has undergone this compensatory adaptation, there's two problems. One, as you come off, you're very likely to experience significant withdrawal symptoms,
mm-hmm.
and that's partly because your brain has been changed. And these withdrawal symptoms can include with the target symptom of depression or whatever it might be, anxiety, returning in great severity, and other new symptoms emerging as well. So once on, can be very tough to get off. And then the other problem is there is even some worry that once you've been on these medications long term and your brain has adjusted to their presence, that even when you come off, it's unclear whether the brain can actually renormalize itself with great frequency and regularity, and that this can make coming off really, really difficult. So I think what I'm trying to say here is if you're on the medication and doing well, that's great. And even if you're not doing so well, coming off can be really perilous and difficult because of these withdrawal symptoms. And if anyone wants to go down that path, I think it's really important to recognize that and hopefully get some help in tapering down.
I want to just stay one moment longer on this episodic illness turns chronic. You were saying that our ancestors, our great-grandfathers, our grandfathers, they recognize that blue feeling they have, that scared feeling they have, that depressed feeling they have as something that is just there and will probably go away. We seem to, and correct me if I'm wrong, we seem to come to the place where we don't want to ever feel that way. We don't want to ever have a blue day. We don't want to ever have a depressed day. And so let's find a medicine that keeps us from ever having that. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, and in fact, that's what we've been taught to think. I mean, one of the amazing things that has happened since 1980. So in 1980, the American Psychiatric Association published the third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And actually, in that manual, they made a big decision. Now, historically, doctors, psychiatrists, and everybody had said blue feelings of the type you're just talking about that are often so in response to setbacks in life, divorces, you lose your job, whatever it might be, that's normal, and those are going to pass. And then this sort of really deep melancholy that persists and it seems out of relationship to any sort of happening in life, even that was seen as going to pass, but that was seen as the illness of melancholy. But in 1980, what the American Psychiatric Association, they said, we're not going to distinguish between the two. If you're feeling blue, sad, down, depressed, and even if you have these setbacks in life, we don't care. We're going to call that a disease. And then they began promoting the idea that that's abnormal, that if you lose your job or if you get divorced, that really doesn't enter the equation whether or not you're going to be diagnosed with depression. So they set a different standard that dramatically expanded the boundaries of what we're going to call clinical depression. And then the other thing is, as the American Psychiatric Association, in concert with the pharmaceutical industry, they began promoting the story of normalcy, just as you say, that we're supposed to be sort of happy all the time, we're really not supposed to be feeling blue, or we're not supposed to be feeling anxious. And so suddenly an image was presented to us of this sort of angst-free life. Well, that's a new philosophy. And it's a philosophy that is so out of sync with what everything that literature tells us about, philosophies tells us about from the past. It's like an ahistorical understanding of human beings that they don't feel angst, that they don't feel emotional distress. We do. It's part of life. But in this new commercial environment, the American Psychiatric Association, in concert with pharmaceutical industry, presented a new image of what is normal. And the normal person, I guess, is just supposed to be happy, and kids are supposed to be well-behaved, and they're supposed to love school and sit quietly in their chairs. I mean, it's a foil for thinking about humans that's just ridiculous.
It really sounds like what I hear you saying is we need to reevaluate what we consider to be normal. And not only do we need to reevaluate it, that the scientific community needs to reevaluate what is normal and accept the fact that, hey, we're not perfect. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, listen, right now they say 25% to 30% of Americans experience mental illness each year. Well, when you say that, you know that you're you've expanded the boundaries of mental illness just so in such a ridiculous way. And yeah, we need to realize life is difficult. It's filled with setbacks. There's plenty of reasons to be anxious. There's plenty of reasons sometimes to feel a little depressed. And our kids aren't going to behave perfectly through school right away, and some of them are not going to like school because, frankly, it can be boring.
Yes.
We just need a much more, we need to remember and regain a philosophy that recognizes that life is difficult, our emotions can be difficult, and this idea that we're supposed to be happy and strolling on a beach all the time with some beautiful member of the opposite sex, which is sort of what we see when we...
Sure.
turn on our TV, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's just an idiotic philosophy.
I almost hate to ask you this next question because I know it's going to make me mad. Who is making money off of this? Who is profiting from the fact that we believe the way we believe these days?
Well, of course, pharmaceutical companies. I mean, in the 90s and beyond, as this idea was promoted and sort of the pathologizing of American children and adults took place, you see the big money earners in terms of sales of prescribed drugs were the psychiatric drugs. Antipsychotics, in, I think in 2008, generated more revenues for pharmaceutical companies than any other class of drugs. Antipsychotics, think about that. And antidepressants became big revenue generators. So first you have drug companies. But then you also had money flowing from the drug companies to those academic psychiatrists who were sort of opening up these new markets. We're saying, hey, we've discovered that ADHD is a much more common condition than we previously thought, or they expanded the boundaries for diagnosing bipolar, expanding the boundaries for diagnosing anxiety disorders. A lot of money flowed from pharmaceutical companies to those academic psychiatrists who helped expand these boundaries. And, you know, psychiatry as a guild also since 1980 has been running public relations campaigns saying that one disorder after another is under-recognized, under-treated, and we have these new therapies that, you know, are so wonderfully effective. So psychiatry as a guild benefited from this story, too. They became very powerful in a way in terms of determining how we feel about ourselves. That's who you see profiting. You see the drug companies. You see psychiatry as a guild. And now we have a sort of whole mental illness industry that has sprung up. And a lot of people are now vested in that industry.
Well, this book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, throws a wrench into the gears of that particular situation, and I recommend it for every one of our listeners today. Robert Whitaker, where can we get a copy of this book? How do we do that?
Of course, you can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
And Bob, is there a website that people can go to learn more about you and the work that you're doing?
Yes, I have a website called madinamerica.com, and you'll find there research news, you'll find source documents, and access to some of the studies I've just referenced in this interview.
Yes.
There's about 150 people who write for the website as well. And I should note I have a new book out on this topic called Psychiatry Under the Influence that just came out a couple weeks ago.
All right, fantastic. Madinamerica.com, Anatomy of an Epidemic, a must-read for those of us who want to be healthy, not only of body, but also of mind. And the author is Robert Whitaker. Bob, thank you so much for being with us today. Always appreciate your words of wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Robert Whitaker inviting you to remain heartwise. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on Heartwise. If you'd like more information on how to build and maintain optimum physical, mental, and spiritual health, log on to heartwiseministries.org. Heartwise is a listener-supported program, and your partnership with us would be greatly appreciated. Once again, our web address is heartwiseministries.org.